From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Even as a large majority of the American public supports the coronavirus-related lockdowns in their states, small but vocal groups of protesters, egged on by some city and state-level leaders, and most of all provoked by President Donald Trump, are calling on governors to liberate them from quarantine. They say their liberty is more important than anything, including life itself. Now, a longtime government insider has written a book about what he calls pitchfork populism and has attempted to analyze how American democracy has dramatically changed since the fall of 2016. His name is Bradford Kane. He served in the U.S. Congress as legislative counsel to Congresswoman Cardis Collins, as counsel to the House Energy and Commerce Subcommittee on Commerce and Consumer Protection, and as a member of President Clinton's Task Force on Healthcare Reform. He also worked for the state of California as Deputy Controller, Legislation, and then as a Deputy Secretary of Information Technology. The entire title of his new book is Pitchfork Populism, 10 Political Forces That Shaped an Election and Continue to Change America. Welcome to the program, Bradford.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what exactly do you mean by pitchfork populism? Sounds a little violent.
Well, I wouldn't call it violent, but the idea is that it is not actually populism. There's a long history in the United States of populist movements. Like in the 1800s, there were eras of economic populism and agrarian populism and other types. And basically what populism is when the masses are empowered to advance their interests. In this case, it's different. Donald Trump tapped into a segment of the population that was kind of very much felt dislocated by both political parties, and he basically stoked fear and resentment, and he empowered them to empower him. He basically mobilized them and motivated them. So the difference between pitchfork populism and real populism is that in this case, he has basically motivated his base to empower him to act often unilaterally with, unfortunately, as we're seeing, very often it approaches authoritarian type of flavor.
One of the issues that you raise in your book that just seems so relevant to today during this time that we're in with the coronavirus pandemic is this principle of rugged individualism versus community collectivism, as you say. And we're seeing Trump supporters, they're a small minority, but they're vocal. They're getting a lot of news coverage. They're showing up at state capitals and cities around the country saying that their liberty is more important than public safety. Is that an illustration of this concept that has now come to mark American politics?
Unfortunately, the coronavirus situation is a microcosm of what I talk about in Pitchfork Populism. One of the main themes that goes on in America, in American history, is that we have a national identity that's kind of a split personality between rugged individualism on one hand and communal collectivism on the other. Coronavirus is a situation where the solution is entirely rooted in collectivism. Everyone has got to participate. And that's one of the reasons why we've seen the curve flatten in certain places like New York, but where else, you know, and of course it's different in different parts of the country. But the whole thing is where there is success, it is because of everyone doing their part, staying at home and wearing masks and hand washing and avoiding risky behavior, and also, of course, social distancing. That is communalism. So when Donald Trump, who, of course, famously in 2016 said, "I alone can fix it," and since then he said things like, "I'm the one who matters," and when he, I think just a couple weeks ago from the White House briefing room, when the question was, what metrics are going to be used to decide when to reopen the economy in the country, he did this. And he pointed to his head as if his judgment, as if he is the ultimate arbiter of truth, as opposed to, first of all, facts, science, truth. People like Dr. Fauci are the people who know the real answer to that. So Donald Trump trying to make it seem like it's about him is completely antithetical to what this country and really the entire world needs to do in order to get past coronavirus. Everyone has to do their part. So these protesters are, and it's befuddling. they are working against their own best interests. It's really baffling, because that when they go into the streets and they're in each other's faces shouting, that's aerial spray. I hate to think what it's going to do in terms of the spread of the disease, but it's entirely counterproductive to their own best interests.
You write in your book that Trump gives the idea of individualism an unprecedented level of importance, because he is the ultimate individualist. I mean, he's not just a believer in individualism. His individual self is the most important. Because it's the most important to him and he's president of the country, he wants it to be the most important consideration for the entire country. Have we ever had a president like this?
Not to this extent at all. We've definitely had individualists. Herbert Hoover was very famous for coining some of the watchwords of that. But this is different. In this case, it's not just a philosophy. What we're used to are presidents who operate based on philosophy, principles, policy. In Donald Trump's case, and I'm sorry to say this, but it's manifestly true, everything that he does is based on his personality and his psychology, his psychological needs. The thing that's really, that makes that case that is really unfortunate, his Twitter feed and his comments that he made at rallies and now that he's making the White House podium, he says things that are based on his own interests, not the national interest. So with his Twitter feed, things he's when he'll send out a dozen, two dozen, three dozen in a day, and sometimes early, like in the middle of the night, it's a transparent view into his own mind. So normally we don't talk in terms of people's side. There's something called the Goldwater Rule, where psychiatrists were not supposed to interpret someone without having a face-to-face evaluation. This is different. He's putting his psychology in the public domain. He does it constantly every day. When he's at the White House briefing room talking about coronavirus, and he answers a question by bringing in the impeachment situation, and at one point he was talking about testing is perfect, which first of all, it's not. It's incredibly deficient with regard to the federal role enabling states and hospitals to do what they need. But the question was about testing, and he said it's perfect. And then he said, like the phone call, meaning the phone. And then he went into he launched into, you know, the bit about with Ukraine. That shows, once again, this is all from his mindset, all about him. He unfortunately has taken an attitude, l'état c'est moi, that's from Louis XIV, I am the state. He believes that if it's good for him, it's good for everyone, for good for the country. It is completely opposite, antithetical to our national heritage, our constitution, our mindset, our democracy, and I think there will be accountability awaiting him.
How do you explain how he attracts his base to himself? This is the type of psychological manipulation that political candidates could only dream of, to have this level of loyalty that, and he knows it. I mean, he said during his campaign that he could, and I'm paraphrasing here, go out into the middle of the street and shoot someone and still not lose support. He knows it, and his base sticks with him. There's a certain percentage of the population that wavers, maybe 10 to 20%. So you see his approval levels rise up to 50 something, but then falls back down. But there's always this floor of 30 to 40% that backs Trump no matter what.
A couple of very important points about that. First of all, to his credit, he identified a slice of Americans who felt like they were not being treated well by either political party and who felt disengaged. And basically, he tapped into their fears, their resentment, their grievance mentality. And instead of just simply validating it, he exacerbated it. He basically legitimized it and became their champion on those bases. A lot of them have fears about the change in the country, demographic change, which most of us consider to be part of the American heritage and the beautiful fabric of America, that we are e pluribus unum, of many one. But from his point of view, he wants to go back to the 1950s, as if this were the Ozzie and Harriet, Leave It to Beaver, Father Knows Best world. And he's actually trying to turn the clock back to that type of a demographic where people who were not in the mainstream were shuttled to the side. Well, the United States rejected that in the 1960s, and ever since then, progressively. He wants to turn that clock back. Now, the other thing that's very important is when you talk about what numbers, and you said 10% of this, I think it's very important to note that his job approval number, well, first of all, in 2016, he won with only 46.1% of the vote, of the popular vote. So already, he was starting from considerably less than half. But now his polling numbers, job approval numbers, which are often anywhere between 40 up to 46, down to 38, up to 47, somewhere in that range, that does not reflect his base. It's very important to note that the diehard base is only, and I make this case in chapter 10 of the book, it's 20 to 25% of the electorate. Those are the people who are with him through all, where he can shoot the Constitution in the face on Fifth Avenue, which is what he did with Ukraine and there's many other situations with the Emoluments Clause. That they don't care. But that's only 20 to 25%. There are a lot of other people who voted for him and who give him job approval numbers for other reasons. But they are not, so for example, there are some people who don't like him but are only going to vote Republican no matter what because they always have and their families always have. So that's a different, that's a slightly different thing. But there are also a lot of Republicans who maybe did not like the other choices or who felt like, well, we don't really know what he's about, so we'll give him a chance. No one can say they don't know what he's like anymore. There's no one in America who can claim, as they may have in 2016, like, oh, I don't know, maybe he's going to be okay, so let's give it a try. There's no one who has no information about who Donald Trump really is. So that number beyond the base and beyond some more, there are a lot of people who are in the middle and who are possibly reachable by Joe Biden and or other forces.
One of the big changes in this country that, in addition to the fact that there's a slice of the American population that feels deeply left out and deeply disenfranchised, and the reasons for that we can have a whole different discussion about. But another big change is demographic change. Our country is becoming browner. It is a demographic shift that the Trump base is terrified of. How does that play into, was that part of the perfect storm that led to Trump's winning of the Electoral College in 2016?
Absolutely was. I talk about demographics and race and the evolution of society in chapter 2. First of all, part of it is pure numbers and people. The Census Bureau estimates that we are going to become a majority-minority country in which communities of color are larger numerically than whites in the year 2042, although they adjust that year to year, so maybe they've adjusted by a year. But 2042 is one of their recent estimates. Now, the thing is, some people, especially within his base, don't accept that, as if, like, you know, I don't know what their alternative is. But that's why you see the anti-immigrant movement that he tapped into. He threw fuel on the fire, for that matter. He came down the escalator. He began by saying some incredibly adverse things that were unjustifiable and just horrific right out the gate. What you're seeing here is that there's kind of growing pains, and it's also a generational thing. Older Americans who were used to some other kind of an earlier mindset, they seem to be that. I'm not saying this about all older Americans. I am talking about his base. The strength in his base is among older people, although that doesn't mean that all older people see it that way. But among the people who really support his mentality and his grievance mentality and the fears and resentment that he champions, that's partly a generational thing, whereas younger generations, they grow up with people black and brown and every different ethnicity and culture in their classrooms and next door neighbors, and it's a different society. So you do see a definite difference generationally, and that will continue to flow. There are some growing pains. He's going to make it ugly this year. But I really, I'm actually optimistic that in this, in the years to come, that there's going to be a lot more of a national embrace bit by bit.
Well, you know, people have tried to analyze the Trump presidency as the almost sort of inevitable outcome of a devolving political landscape that, you know, we thought George W. Bush was the absolute worst president we could have ever had. And so we elected Obama, and then came Trump, who makes George W. Bush look sane and rational. But you're optimistic that we can swing the pendulum back. Right now, we have somebody who is who's fighting Trump for the election, who unfortunately doesn't represent much of anything new in American politics. It's not like Joe Biden represents anything other than just the pre-Trump status quo. And he's sadly quite a weak candidate.
I would take issue with that. I really believe that, first of all, it's a question of who are we as a country? What do we value? What principles are important to us? For a lot of us, we cared very deeply about constitutional principles and all the amendments of the Constitution and everything that happened in the 1960s when we became more of a of an inclusive, diversity and inclusion, equity, equality are a vital element to what makes us the country that we are. And so Joe Biden, when, you know, as opposed to, it's not just a question of going back, it's a question of being who we are. And I believe that he very much is focused on those kind of underlying fundamental American principles. It's not called going back when you just simply want to remind the country, hey, here's how we got here. We've always, and keep in mind, there have been tensions, you know, historically also, go back to the 1800s and the 1920s. Every time some other group comes into the country, you know, there's this, you know, there's some people who get bent out of shape. But the point is that what we're about is an integrated society where people have opportunity and collaborate together. And so the fact that Joe Biden believes in those principles and wants to make that the norm again, that I don't call that going backward.
Well, we shall certainly see what happens in November and whether a majority of Americans believe that or not. Certainly, I think anybody who is seeing what's taking place across the country with a clear-eyed vision can see that Biden would be a massive improvement on Trump. So let me ask you, what about Republican opposition to Trump? There are groups that, you know, George Conway, Kellyanne Conway's husband, is leading, that are saying that they'll support Biden, that are trying to, you know, talk to their own Republican colleagues, their fellow Republicans, to really end the era of Trump. Can there be some success from that angle of American politics to change where we are now?
Absolutely. There are a lot of Republicans who care deeply about the United States, obviously, no kidding. So the thing about Donald Trump, and you mentioned George W. Bush before, let me mention something about a contrast. I have a feeling that if you and I sat down over a beverage, we'd find that we have a lot of the same thoughts with regards to President George W. Bush. However, I never doubted that he loved the United States. I never doubted that for a second. In the case of Donald Trump, I think the only person he loves is Donald Trump. So that's a completely different thing. With George W. Bush and his administration, sure, a lot of us who have friends also on the other side of the aisle, we had vigorous debates, but there was not a question about, you know, is he doing what he thinks is best for the country? That doesn't apply with Donald Trump. So that gets to also why a lot of Republicans today are like, if you listen to Steve Schmidt, who used to work for George W. Bush, and Matthew Dowd, who worked for Bush, and David Frum, who worked for Bush, and on and on and on. There's a whole bunch of them. They are repulsed by Donald Trump being focused only on Donald Trump instead of the good of the country.
Are they speaking out loudly enough, do you think?
Oh, yeah. I've heard Steve Schmidt He is incredibly articulate and he is harsh with regard to the Trump administration.
Michael Steele, the former head of the RNC, has also spoken out and said, he said that Trump has abused America.
Absolutely. Michael Steele's tremendous. But that's because these are people who love the United States, are patriots, and they don't believe in there being any room for authoritarianism that harkens. I mean, you've seen that Donald Trump is very fond of a lot of these, what that we call strongmen. I don't like that term, actually, because strongmen are usually weak, personally, overcompensating. And so they're doing their authoritarian thing in their country and using power the way they can to get away with it. Donald Trump emulates that. When he congratulated President Xi of China for becoming president for life, and he made a joke about wouldn't it be nice here. That's Donald Trump's mindset. So when you talk about Republicans who have no tolerance for that, that's very much rooted in that, because we a lot of us share the same underlying values of what America is and who we are as a people. An example also, environmental concerns. That is a huge issue that applies also on among a lot of Republicans as well. Donald Trump, it's been underreported because of coronavirus, but Donald Trump in late March had his EPA issue some kind of a memo that basically said that they're not going to be enforcing environmental regulations. What? It is so offensive, it's beyond belief.
I want to thank you so much, Bradford, for joining us today. Good luck with your book.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
My guest has been Bradford Kane. He has served many years in the federal government and in California state government, and has just written a book that we've been discussing, Pitchfork Populism, 10 Political Forces That Shaped an Election and Continue to Change America. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.